This is Basma Farhat with the People Speak Radio here with the People Speak Way Make a Difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night from 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website at www.thepeoplespeakradio.org. There you can also listen to past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. I'm sorry, .net. We changed that. And now you can also listen live on satellite through your Nokia phones. Go to the website for details. We're very proud and pleased to have with us two very special guests tonight. Our guests are Cindy Morgan and her son, Kenny Elliott. Cindy served as a contractor driving a truck in Iraq, while her son, Kenny, served in the U.S. military in Iraq. Now, that's quite an interesting duo. Welcome to our show, Kenny and Cindy.
Thank you.
Cindy, the trip to Iraq for you sounds almost like an adventure novel. When you went to Iraq, did it feel like an adventure?
Most definitely. It felt like an escape and an adventure.
And what were you expecting to find there?
Yeah, I'm really not sure. Mainly, hopefully, myself, which is a good thing I accomplished. I was running away from lots of things, running to lots of things, running away from an abusive husband who had tried to kill me about 8 months earlier. Hoping to find out who I was, and with my son being in the military and the long family history of military that we have, to support the troops and to do for somebody else's son or daughter what I knew somebody would do for my son one of these days.
Kenny, you served 3 months with E Troop in the 151 Cavalry?
Yes, ma'am.
And what kind of going as a contractor and going as, let's face it, the contractors don't have the greatest reputations, especially with everything going on with Blackwater these days. Tell us your version of what's going on there, Cindy.
Well, you know, and the thing is, you've got bad apples. I don't care what you do or where you do it. You know, there's always those, and those are the ones you're always going to hear about. You don't hear the stories of, like me, and I met some children there who were poor, running around the desert barefooted, and bought shoes for them, and bought clothes for them, and things like that. And a lot of contractors did that. I had people sending me toys for them, and I would hand them out when I went down the road. And there was a lot of contractors that did that kind of stuff. And a lot of our contractors are former military, you know, either Vietnam War veterans. Some of them are Iraq War veterans and have gotten out and are going back over as civilian contractors. Some are veterans from just, you know, peacetime. And, there's some money to be made there. But, for me and my belief, and I'm sure there'll be, you know, for every person that stands up and says it's more than the money, there'll be one that says it's only the money. But, for me, it was more than the money. In my mind, there's not enough money to go play Russian roulette with your life voluntarily when you can leave anytime you want, unlike the military. It was a dedication. It was a love of my country. It was a belief that we were doing some good, and probably one of the most gratifying jobs I ever had, because at 123 degree temperature in the middle of the desert, when you bring a soldier a bag of ice, you change their life, even if it's just for an hour or so while that ice is there, and is, you know, especially edible ice, and to know that you can make that little bit of difference and make their life a little bit better for that little bit of time while they're facing life and death situations. It's very satisfying.
Were you and Kenny, you and Kenny weren't there at the same time, were you?
Yes, ma'am,
I don't
we
know
were
what
during my second year.
Your second year? I see.
We had to see each other in Baghdad at Baal twice.
I think it was actually about three times.
Three times? Okay.
Yeah.
was that a planned, I mean, obviously it was planned. Was that something that was encouraged because of the fact that both you and your son were there, Kenny? Was that something the military didn't have a problem with?
Well, as soon as I let my commander and my platoon leader and all know that my mother was there, they all looked at me like, we're in Iraq, aren't we? And they were all for it. They were, a bunch of us were having morale problems because we were away from our families and, you know, halfway across the world. And they thought it was cool that I could actually see my mom a couple times while I was there.
Well, let me ask you, Ken, your mother being a contractor, and I know that even there, that a lot of the military have a great deal of resentment towards the contractors. Did any of that manifest around you, or did you see any evidence of that?
No, not on my part. All my buddies that were there, they all thought it was pretty cool that my mother, a woman that was a female truck driver, came to Iraq to do some good. I mean, they supported her, and other contractors. We worked alongside the contractors quite often, quite frequently. And I mean, we really didn't see anything go wrong. A lot of the bad things y'all hear nowadays, you know, that's all you hear. You don't, a lot of times you don't hear the good things that went on, both on the contractor side and the military side.
Let me let's be clear here. This is a war, and as a contractor and as a soldier, did you find that on the ground that the ground war itself was what you expected?
I'll let my mom answer that one first.
Okay.
Well, you know, I've never served in the military, so as far as expectations of what war is, I don't think anybody can. I mean, you can have an idea. You've seen movies, you see things on TV, and you form some kind of concept. And if you have friends that served and have actually served during wartime, you get their advice. If you're smart, you get every bit of advice and soak it all up as you can. And you can get some kind of preconceived idea. But and I've heard this from soldiers and I've heard this from contractors. No matter how much they tell you stateside, it never prepares you for what you will experience in the combat zone. Whether that is good or whether that is bad, it never compares to what you actually experience.
What about you, Ken?
And she's absolutely right. Everything that I went through training-wise, it gave me an idea of what I was about to walk into. And when I got there, it was some of what I had expected. But when we got over there, when I got there to rejoin my unit, they were actually near the end of their tour and all. And, you know, I eventually volunteered to stay and was attached to another unit. But when I first got there, it was a very, very eye-opening experience and life-changing. I mean,
you know,
I went from...
When you talk about it being life-changing and eye-opening, in what way? What were some of the... Describe some of the more disturbing things that you saw there.
Disturbing?
Not all of it's disturbing, and I want to make that clear. Because... It really aggravates me that people want to focus on the negative. Yeah, there's some negative, and some of it is disturbing, but there's a lot that isn't. You actually realize how lucky you are to live in the country that we live in and be grateful for some of the freedoms that we have and opportunities that we have here and all. To me, it depends on what kind of person you are as to what you want to focus on. If you want to focus on negative, then that's what you're going to find. If you want positive, then that's what you're going to find. for
myself. Well, I agree wholeheartedly with that. But let me ask you both this. Do you think that Iraq was necessary? Cindy?
Yes.
Me and my mom have different opinions on that. This is actually probably one of the first times that me and her have sat down and went into it. I believe that, yes, by all means, we should have went to Afghanistan as a soldier and now as a civilian. You know, my opinion is limited due to the fact of, you know, I followed orders. I was not sent over there on my own free will. I was given an order and I went. The initial invasion to Iraq, I don't agree with. But now that we are there, we must finish what we started. If we pull out too soon.
What does finish look like, Ken? What does finish look like? And then maybe Cindy can elaborate on what her idea of finish looks like.
We have a long road ahead of us to help the Middle East and other countries that are dealing with terrorism. It's not just Iraq and Afghanistan. If you watch the news, if you read the paper and you read stuff online, you see that there is terrorism in other countries, even here at home. And finish the job, to me, means go ahead and finish taking out the terrorists in both Afghanistan and Iraq and broadening our spectrum and all, and then bring us home. But don't bring us home too fast, because we have to have a stronghold somewhere. And all, it's better, and I'm not one of the biggest Bush supporters, but I do support him on a lot of things he does and says. One of the best things I agree with what he said is it's better to fight them in their home country than to have them fight on our home front. Because this country is not ready for the war to come home.
Do you think we'll ever be ready, Ken?
No. This country as a whole, in general, will never be ready.
Cindy, Ken and I agree on that. I don't think that we as an American society are ever ready to face the horrid things that happen in war. And although there are maybe some good things that came out of this, it is still a war. And hundreds of thousands have died, whether through shock and awe or through the devastation of the country and the poor living conditions. What does finish look like for you, Cindy?
Finish, to me, was to not see children walking through the desert barefooted because their parents can't clothe them and stuff. Finish for me would to know that they have clean running water, electricity, that they're afforded some of the opportunities that our children have. And I'm talking about basic needs. Because when you see them out in the deserts of Iraq and they're living in little mud huts and maybe they might have some intermittent electricity and they're drinking and swimming in water that you know cannot be the most healthy thing around, it tears your heart out. I mean, when I have a 9-year-old child begging me to bring him back to the United States, and all, it tears your heart out because, I mean, these kids were loved. You know, the little brothers, Agnon and Ida, that I met, I could tell very well they were raised with good morals and good standards, and they were very well loved. But to see the palaces that Saddam built across the country and to see the common folk out there living as they did, to me, was outrageous. Totally outrageous. And I know that happens in other parts of the world as well, and it's sad, and I know it's not the United States place to go and police every one of them. But I'm getting in on the humanitarian side there and stuff, and I know that there's so many aspects to our being there, it's hard to cover them all. As far as the terrorism aspect of it, there's terrorists all over this world. And Saddam was you know, housing some of them. Maybe he didn't have a direct contact with 9/11. But one thing I have found by traveling across this planet and stuff is that, you know, people need to wake up. They need to understand that what happens on the other side of the world does affect us. To stick your head in the sand and think, oh, that doesn't affect us, they're wrong. And one of these days they'll wake up and they'll see it. And I agree with Kenny. Right now this country is not ready for this to come home. First off, the people don't believe it will come home. And until they do believe, they're not going to get prepared so that they can handle it.
For people that have just arrived and are listening in tonight on The People Speak, our guest tonight is Cynthia Morgan and her son Kenny Elliott. Cindy served as a contractor driving a truck in Iraq, and while her son Kenny served in the U.S. military in Iraq. For those of you that would like to ask a question of Cindy or Kenny, please call toll-free 1-877-489-635 or 888-228-4494. Let me ask both of you this, and I think because it's fascinating to have the two different perspectives. First of all, Cindy, do you believe that we have grown, that the American military and what is happening in Iraq has grown dependent on contractors?
Unfortunately, yes. And that's one of the problems of downsizing the military in the drastic manner that they've been downsized, is that nowadays our military, I mean, granted, it puts a lot, it allows the military to put more bodies on the front lines and hopefully better train them and prepare them for what they're going into so that more of them will survive and come home. But it also leaves the military where they don't have as many people in the support positions to handle the stuff, you know, behind the wire, as you put it, you know, inside the wire, the laundry, the cooking, the hauling the supplies around and things like that. And unfortunately, I believe our military is dependent on contractors nowadays, which is a sad thing, because if they put that towards our military and being able to support themselves, maybe they could raise the pay of our military and pay them a little bit more than what they're getting, because they darn sure don't get paid enough.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Kenny, how do you feel that your mother was making more money than you in Iraq?
It wasn't about the money. For me, it was just another job. I went over there, I did what I was told to do, and I got out, and I came home. As for, is the military dependent on contractors? Well, yet again, another topic that me and my mother disagree on. I believe that if the military, the whole military in part, really wanted to.
Sounds like a good old American family to me.
Oh, there's a lot of topics we agree on.
We respect each other's opinions on that, and that's
wonderful.
One of the nice things.
That's wonderful. I apologize for interrupting, Kenny. I couldn't help but throw that in as a mother. Go right ahead, please.
It's all right. It's very understandable. But there are a lot of topics we do agree on. This just happens to be one of the ones we don't. I believe the military in whole could very well support itself. We have all the MOSs. We have all the, we have all the jobs in the military to do the laundry, the cooking, the police, the even all the way down to mopping the floors. You know, everybody does that. And, I mean, we have the capabilities of supporting ourselves. Right now,
so
we do need a little help, and that's where the contractors come in.
Do you think that the contractors are hindering the recruitment process here in the United States? I mean, let's face it, no matter what, it may not have been a monetary issue for you or your mother, but for a lot of people, they're looking at the dollars that contractors are making, and they're making some big bucks. Do you think that this is actually hindering the recruitment process here for military enlistment?
Actually, I don't think so. I know a lot of people that, you know, I talk to them, they find out I'm in the military, and they go, well, I'm thinking about going into the military. How's the pay? And I tell them, it's not great. but it's a way of life. You learn a lot. You get to experience a lot. You make friendships that you'll never, ever make as a civilian. I mean, I've got buddies of mine that are over there now and that are at home that till the days we die, you know, we're going to have a bigger bond than, you know, your best friend that you grew up with and you have. It's just one of those things. Money-wise, you know, it's not that great, but I really don't think that the contracting jobs are hindering the United States, the enlistment. I think it's the people themselves, because they do not understand what they're getting into, and when they go in and they talk to that recruiter and they turn around and watch the news, they freak out. They're not...
Let me ask you, what do you mean by they don't understand what they're getting into?
The military, in part, it's what you make of it.
Mm-hmm.
It can be hard or it can be easy. If you walk in as Private Joe Snuffy and you do what you're told, when you're told, and you're on time, life is going to be easy. But if you get in and you decide to rock the boat, you're going to have a hard time, and it's not going to be what you want it to be.
And if I may interject, I think also a lot of it is how we raise our kids nowadays. My parents were raised, and my kids were raised, and my grandparents were raised to love and support our country. And nowadays, the option of military service is not something that our kids are very well educated on, because we have groups out there that are, you know, are campaigning against, you know, having recruiters come in and talk to these kids, whether it's in high school or in college. And, I mean, on my mom's side alone, every male member of my mom's side of the family has served in one branch of the military or the other, and some of them in two different branches, all the way back to World War I that I know of, including my grandmother. And we don't raise our kids like that anymore. We don't raise our kids with values like that anymore. Nowadays, it's all about that almighty dollar. And if you don't get the dollar and you don't keep up with the Joneses or do better than the Joneses, then you're a failure. And to me, that's a problem.
You were hurt in Iraq, Cindy. Can you tell us about that and what happened?
Which time?
Oh, okay. All I know is that you came home with shrapnel in you, and I want to know about that.
Okay. And I hate to say that I had shrapnel in my arm, because this was little pinhead-sized pieces of metal. I went through the first 9 months of my first year over there and never saw any small arm fire, never was ambushed. But the last 2.5 months I was there, I went through 6 ambushes. I had made convoy commander at that time. Back in July, one of my drivers, he was back in like number 12 truck, he had been shot in the leg, and we airlifted him out. That had a very big impact on me, made me even more dedicated and want to seek other ways of protecting the guys that I run with, because I saw it as, and as any commander, you know, you feel that their lives are in your hand. And even though I was a civilian and stuff, I just had that dedication. I didn't want to mother them, because, you know, these are grown men, but you do what you can to protect them and make them as knowledgeable as you can. Back on August 21st of 2004, I went through my 6th ambush, and it was the worst that I had ever been through. As a civilian convoy commander for KBR, the CC rides in the first truck, and the first 2 rounds of that ambush hit my truck. It was at night, it was like 10:30 at night. There was a flash, and I heard my driver scream, and as he screamed, there was another flash, and you hear this, and you hear the bullets tear through the truck, and I felt the burn on the backside of my right arm, and my driver's hollering at me, and he's on the radio, because I was driving, and he's sitting over the passenger seat. And he's wanting to know if I'm okay, and I'm wanting to know if he's okay, and I'm trying to see who else is getting shot at and who's stopping. And at that time, we had what we call third country nationals. They were from, you know, Pakistanis, Egyptians, Filipinos, guys from Sri Lanka. I mean, just from all over that drove trucks with us at that time. And one of my Egyptian guys had gotten shot, and he stopped in the middle of the ambush. My bobtail guy come up, got him out of the truck, threw him in his truck while under fire, bullets pinging around him, directed the rest of the convoy around while we tried to get out, and my escorts tried to lead us out of the kill zone. We get to where we think we're out of the kill zone, and I jump out of the truck because I can't get to Robert's knee from inside the truck. I run around and grab my knife off my vest and slit his pants leg open and just start to get a bandage on his knee. When we started taking gunfire again, he's hollering at me, "Cindy, get in the truck, Cindy, get in the truck," few choice words, "Cindy, get in the truck." And I'm like, "You're not going to bleed out on me. I'm going to get this bandaged." And I got the bandage wrapped around his leg and went to jump down from the side of the truck. That's when I realized that one of the soldiers out of my lead escort was standing pretty much literally between me and the bullets, covering me. And he covered me as I ran around the front of the truck and got back in the truck. I looked in my rearview mirror, saw that the military green vehicle behind me, the transport vehicle, had shoved a four-wheeler up underneath the back bumper of my trailer, and the convoy thus was trapped. The last they had heard was that both of us were hit, even though mine was very minor. When our truck didn't move, when the bullets started flying, it fell to them and their responsibility to get the rest of the convoy out of the area. And that car got in the way, and they couldn't. And I made a split-second decision, and I turned my steering wheel and went around my lead escort as they covered us. You know, they were returning heavy fire, and got about 100 yards up the road. The road was blocked. There were two tankers that were positioned where they had the road blocked and had traffic. And I looked at Robert, and I said, "Hold on." And I started plowing cars, and the military vehicle behind me, as I made the hole, he finished cleaning it out so that we could get our convoy out of the area so that we didn't get trapped. Because if we had stopped, we'd been sitting ducks. You know, they could have just picked us off however they wanted. And this was all
in the last 6 months of your tour of duty there.
It was 5 days before KBR fired me and sent me home.
As a matter of fact,
they wanted me to go out on a mission the next day, and my guys were so shook up and stuff, they needed a break. And I told my boss there and my foreman, I said, "These guys have just been shot at. We've had one injured. They need a break. You know, you need to give them 24 hours off so they can relax and calm down." And they said, "Well, we need a convoy commander. We're short of convoy commanders." And I said, "Well, you give my guys the day off and I'll go." And I staged a convoy that afternoon, and luckily, because of escort problems and stuff that evening, we didn't push out that night. It was the next day. I was out on that mission when KBR terminated me.
And then they fired you. That sounds like a perfectly wonderful thing to do to your employees. We have a caller online.
There were a lot
online.
Of contributing factors to that.
We have a caller. I'm not gonna let you get away with this one, Cindy. We're gonna go into this in more depth, but we do have a caller that's been waiting for a little while. Steve from Santa Fe. Steve, do you have a question for our guest today?
Yes, I do, Bossman. Thank you, and thank you, Cynthia and Kenny, for coming on the mic. I'm a combat veteran of Vietnam. And
thank you.
My question would be, how does all of this rectify? I mean, I listened to both of you tell me why you went. I can understand your son. I mean, because I was there and had no real recourse to say no. But how does this rectify the millions that this war has killed? I realize and sympathize with you and your comrades that were wounded, but we're not talking about the millions of innocent people, including half of that being children, that have died. For what? Mike Sophie.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to get into political statements and and trying to justify what our government does, because that's the only way I can correct that is by getting out and voting for people that I think will make the decisions that I hope that they will make. All I can speak to is my belief, and I don't know what goes behind the scenes, and I am not privy to all the details of what goes on. Unfortunately, there have been a lot of innocent people killed, and that is part of war, and as a Vietnam veteran, you know that. It comes down to the question, do you want it there or do you want it here?
Well, I just assumed it was nowhere myself, but let's get back to, thank you, Steve, for your question, very important. And as you can see, a lot of people are not in agreement with everything that's going on there. So it's a very difficult situation.
Well,
no matter how
we
look at it.
I can sympathize with everybody not agreeing with everything over there and all, but one of the things I must say is if you don't support the war, you don't agree with it, please support our troops. Our troops are over there. You know, yes, this military is a volunteer military. We all volunteered. Excuse me. We all raised our right hands and swore an oath to protect this country and do and take our orders as we were told by the commander-in-chief. And, we got orders to go over there. Some of us volunteered to go over. Some of us volunteered to stay, like I did, while we were there. But that was, and, you know, I don't speak for most. I don't speak for everybody in the military who has volunteered to go or volunteered to stay while they were over there. But I do know a lot of them who have, and it was for personal reasons, such as they didn't want to leave certain people behind. They wanted to make sure that they got home, or they wanted to make sure they made it through another year. And I stayed over there because I went over as a replacement, did 3 months, and my unit came home. I didn't make the initial push with them because I was still in the process of finishing my training when they left for Iraq. When I got over there, I did my 3 months, and they looked at me and went, "You ready to go home?" I looked at them and went, "I can't do it." And they asked me why, and I told them, "I don't see a reason for me to come over here, do 3 months, and go home with y'all and say that I did something. It was a personal thing for me, and all. And you know, I had friends in other units from all over the country, and I knew that a couple of them were there. So I volunteered to stay, and I was attached to another state's National Guard, and I did another 6-7 months while I was there.
You know,
well, thank you,
Kenny. And
there's,
you know what we're going to do? We're going to take a little break right now and get right back into this. We still have a lot of questions, and we've got questions from our audience and listeners. Please feel free to call us toll-free internationally, 877-489-6350. And that's in the U.S. And in USA and Canada, 888-228-4494. Go to our site, www.thepeoplespeakradio.net, and get the information. You can download and you can stream the conversation right there. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Cynthia Morgan and her son, Kenny. Thank you very much, folks. We'll be right back.
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
According to polls, a majority of Americans support the impeachment of Dick Cheney. To make people aware of this, the Honk to Impeach campaign has been organized. People will be carrying Honk to Impeach signs in front of congressional district offices and TV and radio stations. Visit impeachspace.com and impeachcheney.org for updates of this effort. And don't forget to honk for impeachment.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
Got questions? The library has got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the People Speak Radio. We're here with Cynthia Morgan and her son, Kenny, who were both in Iraq, mother as a contractor and son as an American military soldier. We have a couple of questions here that I'd like from our audience members that I'd like to get in. Lynn from Hamilton, Ontario in Canada. What about all the money that's being thrown on the war instead of using the money for better purposes right within the United States?
I'll let my mom answer that one first, too.
Thank you, son. I love you, too.
Ladies first.
As I said, you know, I'm not going to get into a bunch of political debates. And I mean, that's just like when I wrote my book, okay? I had people asking me whether I was going to lambaste Halliburton, whether I was going to be pro-Bush, whether I was going to down the military, whether I was going to do this, whether I was going to do that. And what I wanted to do was tell a story, and my story of my experiences, and let people make up their own mind, because it's not my place to make people's mind up as to whether they should be for or against the war. They have to look at all the facts out there and make their own opinions. And as far as the money that is spent on the war, yeah, there's a lot of places that could go. But also, when I stopped, and one of the first things that I noticed when I came home, or I realized when I came home, was that in this country, we are afforded so many opportunities. And I have had, and I said I wasn't going to do this, but we've had so many people say, you know, we've got homeless, we've got, you know, this and we've got that. We're in a country that everybody could be working if they would swallow their pride and take the job that they have. Well, I shouldn't say could be. Most could be and all. And because we won't take that little McDonald's job or we won't go work in a field, you know, pulling in what they say the illegal Mexicans are doing, will sit on welfare, and our welfare system perpetuates that. So I have a problem, you know, with people saying, you know, we need to be spending all this money at home when we have people who wouldn't even take advantage of it if we put it out there.
Do you want to respond to that, Kenny, at all?
I'm pretty sure most of the viewers are what's the word? I'm familiar with the term catch 22.
Mm-hmm.
If the military doesn't have that money, we don't have the necessary equipment to defend our country, to train, to put forth the effort to help other countries and help this country in natural disasters and everything. Then again, you know, if we don't have the money and we put it towards this country and we help the homeless, we help, you know, everybody, and we do everything everybody wants us to do with that money instead of give it to the military, then yes, hey, great. But like I said, if the military doesn't have it, we don't have the money to do what we need to do. And then if we do, the country doesn't have the money to do what everybody thinks it should do. So in that situation, it's a catch-22. There's no way out.
It's the old saying, you know, you can't please everybody. And it doesn't matter what this country does with it. There's going to be somebody out there that's going to say, and they're going to have their cause, and they're going to want it to go towards that, and they're going to think everything else is wrong.
Exactly.
Jane from California asked, did you have any opportunities to help the Iraqis themselves? For example, children.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Lies.
Can you share some of your
stories? I'll let Kenny tell his story first. He's got a beautiful story here.
We had med caps. We had where we went out, we gave medical treatment to the locals. We'd set up a perimeter to help keep the bad guys out, if you will. And we would divide everybody up by the gender, you know, kids, men, and women. And we would set up our military medics in a building, and they would go in and they would get medical, dental, shots, everything and all. Another instance is of that little girl that I was talking to you while we were on break. This little girl, when my unit met her before I got there, when they met her, she had lice, so she had to go through the delousing process, which meant burning of the clothes, the shaving of the head, and all. Well, when I got over there, I met this little girl. Sweetest little girl you'll ever meet. And she took to me real fast, me and my platoon sergeant. Me and him treated her like she was our own daughter. And I don't have kids, but I love kids. This girl, every day, when she saw our military vehicles, knew instantly where I was. She would run up. She would, you know, holler, Mister, Mister. And if she couldn't find me, she would ask for me by name. And I had people from home, you know, I was getting care packages every week with stuffed animals, candy, shoes, and other clothing for these kids over there. And I called home one day, and I specifically asked for one care package to be full of a certain size of little girl clothing, you know, a bunch of girl stuff. And when I came to her, the last day I saw her, her mom and dad had just been killed a day or two before, and she was living by herself. When I gave her those clothes and the toys, it was a moment that, you know, it was one of those you had to be there moments, because when I gave them to her, you could tell that nothing could bother her at that moment, because somebody was reaching out to her, somebody was showing her that they cared, and that they weren't there just trying to take over their country, or they weren't there trying to hurt other people. And on, they actually cared.
Yes, I had the same experience with Agnon and Ida. I had people sending stuff, and those two little boys I got to know a little bit better than I did some of the others. But through my 2 years there, I handed out, you know, toys, food, clothes, shoes. The day that it's actually Agnon's older brother, who was 12 at the time, who asked me to buy Agnon a pair of shoes. He didn't ask for them for himself. He asked for his little brother, and I told him yes, I would get them, because he had some. He had, Ida had shoes. And so when I made it to Bob, that was the first thing I did, was make a beeline to the PX, and I bought shoes and shirts and socks. And on my way south, I looked, and this little boy lived in one of the camps, or outside one of the camps south of Baghdad, and I looked for him, and well, on my way up, there wasn't concertina wire outside, because I used to stay just lots of times outside the camp on the road, and when I come back south, they had put concertina wire up, and I asked the kids where he was. They said he was sick,
And I had somebody go and get him, and when they brought him up and I handed him, I mean, it was a simple pair of shoes. Our kids in this country, you know, they don't even appreciate a simple pair of shoes, no matter how cheap or how expensive they are. This 9-year-old boy, I mean, it's the barbs on the concertina wire got in his shirt and my shirt because he insisted on giving me a hug for this pair of shoes. And he got tears in his eyes. And he ended up walking away because he didn't want the other kids to see him with tears, or maybe he didn't want me to see him with tears in his eyes. And that's when his older brother came up and asked me, please, please take my brother to America. And I'm like, what about your parents, you know, and what about your mother and father? And he explains to me that his father had been killed a few weeks before our invasion, or whatever you want to call it, of us going into Iraq, because he wouldn't join Saddam's army. He refused to join Saddam's army, so they executed him. And now they were living with other family members, cousins or something other. And he begged me to bring Ida to the United States with him, and I couldn't, you know. We can't do that.
Let me ask you a couple of things, because we're going to be wrapping up soon, and there's so many questions that we have to ask. First of all, I'd like to get back to the important detail about KBR firing you at shortly after you actually were acting in a very heroic manner.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
There's a lot of contributing factors as to why I was terminated. I can give you the official line that they gave me, and I can give you the reasons that I and many people I worked with thought that they terminated me. Their position was that I had violated operational security. I had a blog going on, and 5 days after that last ambush, when my email box was full of 200 and 300 emails asking me if I'd been all right, because all I'd done was call home and tell them I'd been through an ambush. And I was, you know, I had, you know, some metal in the back of my arm, but it wasn't nothing, that I was fine. I'd let them know about it in a few days. You know, people went nuts, because at that time I had a pretty good following, you know, with my blog. And I had, all I'd done was stayed on the front page of it, was that, yeah, we were ambushed again. And, you know, that my driver had been injured, a soldier had gotten glass in his eyes, that I had a third country national shot in the leg, and that I wanted to give my greatest thanks to the 1st of the 86th Field Artillery out of Vermont for covering our tails, and my personal thanks to the young man who stood behind me and stood between me and the bullets, and all.
And because you printed that on the blog, you got fired?
Because I put that on the front page of the blog. That's what they said that they terminated me for. Now, my opinion is, and several other people's opinion, is that a lot of it started because of my complaints about some of their security measures, because I was sexually assaulted in Kuwait and refused to come home, and because I refused to keep quiet about it and told the other females down there, because at the time, we didn't have keys to our rooms. We didn't have keys to the front doors. Anybody could walk in and out whenever they wanted, which I demanded a key after that. And I told other women to get keys, too, because the man was still at large. And I complained about security problems, and I did what it took to make sure that, you know, my guys were taken care of and that my mission was a success and completed with, you know, as safe as possible.
Let me ask you, I know that there is actually a high incidence of rape. Cynthia McKinney, during a presidential speech, said that, and you weren't officially in the military, but it's a very similar situation. Actually, I think it's an unregulated military when you're talking about contractors. At least that's what I've been able to gather. And even in a regulated military, the incidence of rape and sexual assault in the military is 1 in 5. How high is it in the contracting world?
You know, that's a good question, because nobody keeps track of it. As contractors, and as, you know, even for guys who are contractors that are shot, there is no official record of it. It's not kept up with like what it is with the military. I know it happens. I mean, and then back when I was there, and it's, you know, before Jamie Jones and Tracy Barker, and they were told to not walk around by themselves, I was there in September of 03, and it was just, you know, common sense. You don't walk around, especially at night, in a camp by yourself. Of course, what happened to me happened in a Kuwait, in a facility that was supposed to have KBR security on it, which, you know, in my opinion, they failed me on that. But and I want to get something clear. I have a problem with that word. I refuse to be a rape victim. I am a rape survivor, if you have to put it that way. I prefer to put it as a sexual assault survivor, because it's something that I haven't dealt with. I have not gotten the counseling and stuff that some of the other people have gotten, because mine happened so early. And even with it coming out in the book, and I have a detail of it in the book, it's what I would... The little bit of counseling I got in Kuwait when I reported it several months later, when they finally brought me down to Kuwait so that I could talk to the Kuwaitis about it, was the first counseling I got, and that was, you know, several months.
Did you get any other kind of reparation or
no.
Any monetary?
No. When they fired me and brought me home, I got a hold of the EAP counselor I had talked to in Kuwait, David Nix. He's the same counselor who sat with Tommy Hamill's wife when Tommy was kidnapped and flew with them over when Tommy was recovered. I contacted him when I got back to the States, and he had to go all the way to the president of the company to get me 6 counseling sessions, but I had to go to a counselor that was in their system. And during that second session, I popped off the comment, I feel like I'm going crazy, I'm losing my mind, I'm nuts, am I crazy? And she said yes, and I never went back and asked for another counselor, and they wouldn't give me one. So after that, I just, like a lot of people,
How do you feel about KBR?
The best way I can. Huh?
How do you feel about KBR?
You know, I have a problem with people that work for them, and this is one of the things, you know, I don't know what Houston knew and what the people in Iraq knew. I mean, we were always told, forget everything they told you in Houston, it's a different world over here. And we were told, you know, the scuttlebutt was that, you know, Houston doesn't know what's really going on over here, and other people would say, oh, they know very well what's going over here, they turned a blind eye. I don't know what to believe on that. What I do know is that this happened to me on their watch, and in my opinion, I should have had counseling instead of being left to deal with it by myself. Just like the guys who are being shot and sent home and are having to deal with their wounds or their post-traumatic stress disorder, which is very high among our soldiers and our civilian contractors. A lot of them are being left to fend for themselves. Some are getting taken care of as well, but it's kind of hard to not have some resentment against KBR or Halliburton. But then again, also I have to realize that the people on the ground in Iraq are the ones that made the decisions for certain chains of events to happen, and those people I have some high resentment for.
Well, we've come to the end of the show, and I would like to make a couple of comments myself. As a grandmother of Iraqi grandchildren, and knowing and speaking to a lot of Iraqis, I know that although it is too late now, the fact that the Iraqi war was probably a totally unnecessary war, at least in my opinion and many of the people in America's opinion, how we have affected the lives of the Iraqi people is something I think only time is going to completely reveal to all of us. Whether we did more harm than good is something that, again, I think only time is going to tell. I hope that any of the good that came out of this is going to eventually turn into full good. I don't know how much good can come out of war. I'm not committed to war making peace. I'm not one of the proponents of that thing, but I do appreciate both of you for being here. And Kenny, if it matters, I agree. We must support our troops by bringing them home. So I thank you both for being with us this evening. Folks, thank you very much. That's the end of the night. Tomorrow we will have David Swanson, our host, is going to be interviewing Lori Dobson, an independent candidate for the U.S. Senate. Next Monday we'll be having General William Odom, who earned a national reputation as an expert on the Soviet Union. And next Tuesday, I will be interviewing an incredible man, futurist Alvin Toffler. Thank you all for being with us this evening. It's been a pleasure. Cindy, Kenny, thank you. Be well, and we hope that things get perfect for you in your lives. Bye-bye, everybody.
In the shadow of the city wall, by the relief confess, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
Hi, this is Dan Millman, author of Way of the Peaceful Warrior and the new book, Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior, and you're listening to BBS Radio.
You're listening to BBS Radio. An internet radio experience of truth, harmony, beauty. From your family at BBS Radio, have yourself a beautiful day. You're listening to BBS Radio. An internet radio experience of truth, harmony, beauty.